Case number 12-5355 et al. Select Specialty Hospital, Bloomington, Inc. et al. Appellants versus Kathleen Sebelius, United States Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Berg for the appellants, Mr. Waldman for the appellate.
Good morning.
Good morning, Honor. May it please the Court, David Byrd for the plaintiffs, Select Specialty Hospitals. I'd like to reserve at least 2 minutes for rebuttal. The Provider Reimbursement Board in this case acted contrary to the law and the record when it refused to reimburse petitioners for capital costs at the rate provided by the Secretary to new hospitals. As two dissenting board members recognized at the time, the regulatory definition of a new hospital is clear on its face and covers any institution that meets the Medicare statute's definition of a hospital and has operated for less than 2 years prior to the periods at issue. The plaintiffs in this case unequivocally satisfy those two conditions. It is undisputed that each is a hospital that meets the requirements of 1395XE, Medicare statute's definition of a hospital, and that each is a provider of services as defined by 1395XU. It's also undisputed that none of them operated prior to the periods at issue. Nothing more is or should be required for them to claim reimbursements at the new hospital rate.
Yep. Should. That's what you're saying. The argument here is that the majority found that the regulation was ambiguous and that they had to decide.
Well, our first argument is that the majority of the board erred in making that finding, and we believe this court should review the regulation de novo to determine whether or not it's ambiguous with no deference to the board's finding.
And the listing, it was unclear whether that was an exclusive list or not.
Well, I think, Your Honor, with respect to the subparts of what I will call 300B, and I will try to avoid all of the innumerable numerations of this, but with regard to the subparts of the regulatory definition, I don't think whether they're exclusive or non-exclusive is actually that important. The subparts are all lists of hospitals that do not meet the definition that is described in the main part of 300B. Mm-hmm. The subparts make clear that changes in an existing institution's corporate ownership or management, its asset base or facilities, or its participation or status in the Medicare program do not mean that an existing institution, that is an existing hospital, has operated for less than 2 years. But the primary part of 300B focuses on the newness of a hospital, that is the newness of an institution and the length of time it has operated, not the provenance of the assets the institution may have acquired in order to enter the market or the field. If you look at both the primary part of 300B, and if you look at each of the subparts, each uses the term hospital in a way that is consistent and, in fact, can only mean the provider as defined in 1395XE. And yet hospital is the only part of the regulation that the board found to be ambiguous at all. That was an error of law, and this court can reverse based on that alone under a de novo standard of review.
And what is your response to the Secretary's argument in her brief? This is the one where she's saying she's not interpreting the word hospital or even the phrase new hospitals. She's just exercising her discretion on exemptions.
Well, first of all, that's not what the board said in its decision. The board said that the regulation was ambiguous in its use of the word, insofar as it used the word hospital. It was very specific on that point. And we think that's controlling. And the post hoc rationalizations of the government's lawyers here cannot, as a matter of law, change that fact. Mm-hmm. The board did not do as Your Honor suggested. I would also say that even if the board had done as Your Honor suggested, that
I'm not suggesting anything.
Well,
I'm just saying that's the argument the Secretary made in its brief and asking you how you respond.
A perfectly fair point. But even if the board had done as they suggested, that construction would still be erroneous and reversible, mm-hmm. on the theory that, first of all, the regulation is not ambiguous, and second of all, even if there could be some ambiguity in the use of the term hospital or in the regulation as a whole, the construction adopted by the board here and the result that they reached is so flawed and incoherent that it cannot stand and must be reversed.
What if, I mean, is the word new ambiguous?
No, well, certainly, Your Honor, the word new could be ambiguous, but the statute, the regulation, 30B, is there to define what a new hospital is. If you look at it, it says...
Would you concede that it's least ambiguous whether 1, 2, 3, and 4 are illustrative or exhaustive of what new means?
I don't know that I would concede that. I would say that it's completely irrelevant to anything, whether they're exhaustive or not. What 1 through 4 say is the following hospitals are not new hospitals. Now, what precedes that sentence and the listing of 1 through 4 is a statement that a new hospital is a hospital that has operated for less than 2 years.
So the question is, what do we really mean by being a new hospital, i.e., one that's operated for less than 2 years? Well, and one can imagine a long list beyond these four of things that would, for example, this list doesn't include a hospital that operated for 5 years, right? I mean,
Absolutely. The list could go on forever. But my point about both the use of the term hospital in the phrase hospital that has operated for less than 2 years and the term hospital as it appears in each of the subparts is that grammatically and as a matter of clear language and coherence, the term hospital there can only mean the institution that is defined in 1395XE, which is the Medicare statute's definition of a hospital.
Sometimes that definition talks about institutional hospitals. Sometimes it talks about things that sound like the physical structure of the hospital. I mean, I think that simply keeps the question going.
Well, I think, Your Honor, I would say that if you look at the definition, everything that is in the definition is describing an institution that meets certain requirements, including conducting certain operations. Those operations that the institution, the entity, the business organization, the hospital requires will, of course, require physical assets and other types of assets in the same way that this court, Your Honors, requires a courthouse and a building in which to hear cases. But that does not, and of course, in colloquial conversation every day, I tell my father, I'm going to court today. But I don't mean that in a way that is personally invasive of Your Honors. I'm speaking colloquially about the building. But the Medicare statute, Congress has drafted with more care and precision, and the Secretary, when these regulations were promulgated, used the term very consistently.
Why is it your situation since, let's talk about the freestanding hospitals. Why are they not sufficiently like a hospital that closes and subsequently reopens? You had hospital facilities, they closed. In one case, 2 years, you reopened.
Facilities are closed by institutions. The facilities don't close themselves. So each of the freestanding hospitals, as a matter of law, is a new entity that was created by Select Medical Corporation for the purposes of establishing a new entrant into the field of long-term care hospitals. They chose sites of operation, they entered into lease arrangements, and they conducted capital-intensive renovations of those facilities. Those entities, those institutions, which are participants and contracted with the government under Medicare, are, in fact, brand new institutions, and it is stipulated as a matter of fact, and if in the record, that those institutions had no operations prior to the cost reporting period at issue. And let me be very clear on this. Your Honors can look at the joint appendix at page 195 and 312, and you will see the stipulations that the government signed and that the parties agreed to, which says exactly that. As a matter of fact, I think that's conclusive.
I understand that this is not the same as a hospital closing itself and then reopening a year later for whatever reason. But the question is whether, for purposes of the Secretary exercising her discretion in this area, it is sufficiently invalid. Wasn't the board here saying that, look, when you guys start a new hospital, when there was already a hospital not so long ago, it implicates all the same concerns we have here, because those big concerns are, have you already gotten the benefits of the statute?
Well, certainly Select and the Select hospitals that are the plaintiffs in this case have never gotten the benefit of the statute. They tried to claim the benefit of the statute, and that was denied, not because they were not new entrants into the field of services, but because they happened to have entered into a brand new lease with a landlord that was, in the freestanding hospitals examples, not a hospital, to create a new hospital. But the asset that they leased happened to have been used by another unaffiliated medical services provider at some point in the past. And the government's position here, the board's position, seems to be at any point in the past. They want to reach back to assets that have been literally vacant for more than 10 years prior to the lease. So, Your Honor, I think that's the beginning of the answer. Let me come back to the regulation, because what's controlling here is not what would be a reasonable regulation for the secretary to write on a blank slate, but what is a reasonable construction of the regulation that was actually adopted. And that provides a very clear definition. A new hospital is a hospital, we would say, clearly as defined by the Medicare statute, that has operated for less than 2 years. That's a very straightforward test. We meet the statutory definition of a hospital. We've undisputedly operated for less than 2 years. Therefore, if we happen to acquire a used asset, beds, X-ray machines, that may have been installed in another hospital at some point in their life, a building, that does not change the fact that we are within the plain language of the statute. Let me give you a second purpose.
Well, talk about B1, and let's think about the hospitals within a hospital here. And B1 actually contemplates even, you know, new management, different management, lease arrangements.
Certainly.
All these things. And so why, again, I know it's not exactly what you did, but why isn't what the board said here is you're close enough. When you go build yourself within a pre-existing hospital, you lease out that land. The fact that you are a different management or a different owner doesn't change the fact that, look, Medicare money has already gone to that hospital. You know what? You're not going to have the problems of flow of patients and introducing yourself to the community because you're within a hospital that already has you know, eliminated those sort of new entrant barriers for you.
Well, first of all, let me try to give you a three-part answer, and I'll try to get through it all. It'll be a textual answer, a purposive answer, and a more practical answer that's based on the record in this case. The textual answer is that if you look at B1, it still says hospital, and the construction of B1 is completely consistent, and I would say only consistent, with the understanding of a hospital as that term is defined in Medicare. Only institutions build or decide to build newer replacement facilities. The language that you've pointed out, which I think is very interesting about changes in ownership or management or lease arrangements, are complete. First of all, the specific language about previous ownership or changes in ownership or management is completely consistent with the reality that many hospitals, like each of the hospitals in this case, are often owned by a corporate parent. So, for example, if Select Medical Hospital had a hospital that it sold to Acme Manufacturing, for whatever reason, and Acme Manufacturing continued to operate it as a hospital, that would be a change in ownership and potentially management. You could also have situations, and the Common Hospitals of Chandler case from the Ninth Circuit, which is cited by the government in its brief and discussed in our reply brief, is a perfect example of a kind of situation which would help you understand the lease arrangement point in a way that is still completely consistent with our position here, which is that the hospital is and only is an institution that meets the definition of 1395 XE. In Chandler, an existing hospital that was relatively small went through a decision to where it decided to build a brand new, much larger hospital at another site. Acquired, I can't recall if it purchased the property or leased the property, but acquired the property, built the new facility, moved all of its operations over there, and then wanted to be treated as a new hospital for purposes of the particular new hospital regulation that was in effect at that time, which was a predecessor to the one that's here. This was in 1992. And in that situation, the government took the position, essentially, that no, hospital is an institution. And the court, the Ninth Circuit, to Your Honor's point about there potentially being some ambiguity here, said, you know, hospital might mean something slightly different depending on the context, but when we look at this in the entirety of it, we see, and let's see if I can quote from it here, that there is no intent evident in the regulation or otherwise to define hospital as a physical facility. So even if Your Honor thought there could be some ambiguity either with the use of the term hospital in this regulation or with the regulation as a whole, we would submit that the result would essentially be the same. Now, I promised you a purposive answer, and I'd like to give that as well. We focused on the text of the regulation up to this point, but the purposive answer is evident in what the Secretary said when the rules were promulgated in 1991 and 1992 and 2002. And in our brief, we track the evolution of the regulation through that time period, but the definition of new hospital has largely remained the same, at least since 1992. And what the regulation, what the Secretary said in the rulemaking there was that the capital prospective payment system that was being implemented at that time was not designed to be and was not going to be designed to take account for the experience of new entrants into a market who typically have no historic asset base prior to their entry, who typically must go through a capital-intensive startup phase to acquire the assets needed to operate and provide services to patients, and who face potentially, and I stress potentially, low occupancy and Medicare utilization in the first months of operation. And so for those reasons, the Secretary determined that there should be an exemption from the capital prospective payment system for new hospitals, i.e. hospitals that had operated for less than 2 years prior to the periods at issue.
It seems to me like a hospital isn't a hospital. Don't really, just talk about those for a minute. Isn't there an argument that those don't fit within the rationale that you just gave, or at least the Secretary could reasonably determine that they're more like B1, less triggering of the concerns because you're already going to have a patient flow. It's less intensive resources if you're building within a hospital that already has presumably lots of medical supplies and stuff around. And so as to that group, which I guess is 23 of the folks here, perfectly reasonable to say that doesn't count.
Well, Your Honor, I think you've actually perfectly set up the third point that I wanted to make, which is the practical one I promised you. First of all, just as a brief aside on that, the board did not say what you just suggested as far as its construction of the statute. That is not at all what the board said. And a post hoc rationalization to that effect, whether it's from the government or anyone else, should not support the board's decision here. We should, at the very least, get a remand. But since it's a question of law, I think that would not be appropriate. The record point, though, which I think is the one that was really the thrust of Your Honor's point here, is you're saying that hospitals that have co-located with other facilities, like most of the long-term care hospitals here, don't typically fit the typical experience of a new entrant that the Secretary was talking about in the rulemaking proceedings in 1991 and 92 and 2002. And the answer to that is the record here shows the exact opposite. Each of these hospitals went through enormous capital-intensive startup facilities, leasing properties. You know, as I said, I mean, we talked about the hospital that had been, or the facility that had been vacant for 10 years prior to the hospital coming in and leasing it. That's the Victoria Hospital in Miami in the Bloomington case. And in that instance, you have a building that literally had been empty for 10 years. They went in and
that could happen in B1 as well. I mean, I think the fact that there's a lot of resources expended is not sufficient
for
the regulation.
It certainly is not sufficient, and I'm not suggesting that it is sufficient, Your Honor. But Your Honor's question was, suppose you have a brand new entrant that for some reason may not be quite the typical brand new entrant. And my point about that was simply that here there's no reason to think, and in fact the record shows, that these are not anything other than typical entrants. The record shows here that each hospital started up and incurred capital costs that were typical of any new entrant. And the fact that they leased a facility and renovated it, in some cases co-located within the same building as another hospital, doesn't change the fact that they faced the same kind of capital-intensive costs that any hospital would have to face, and that they aren't, in the same sense, a totally new entrant into the market. In fact, because...
They're going to have the same patient flow concerns or relationship with the community concerns that the Secretary has mentioned.
They absolutely will have the same patient flow and community concerns.
Right there within the hospital, and the hopes that people will just shift from hospital care into their long-term care.
Your Honor, my clients would be thrilled if it were that easy. But it is not. And in particular, during the initial startup period, when these long-term care hospitals are operating as general acute hospitals, there are enormous practical difficulties getting off the ground. And by the way, if you look back at the original rulemaking language, the rulemaking language doesn't say that there should be a case-by-case analysis in any given case as to whether this particular new entrant has, in fact, had the kind of experience that warrants an exception. The rule simply says we recognize that the capital prospective payment system that we're implementing is not designed to deal with new entrants, that new entrants generally and typically face these consequences, and that, therefore, we are going to create an exception for them, keyed to the fact that the entity, the institution, has not operated for more than 2 years prior to the period at issue. And, Your Honor, just to close the point on your practical concerns about the co-located hospitals, if bear in mind here that the periods at issue are not the full 2 year periods that are permitted under the statute. In fact, each of these hospitals moved quickly through its certification phase and became certified as long-term care hospitals within 6 to 9 months of their commencing operations. So we're actually talking about a much shorter period of time here. And once they made that transition into what's called a long-term care hospital and are certified as that, then they're moved under a different cost recovery system. And in fact, they essentially, because they've made that transition, no longer can claim cost recovery for capital expenses at the new hospital rate. So they essentially, because they wanted to become certified as soon as possible as long-term care hospitals, they voluntarily elected to give what is essentially their give up what is essentially their right under the regulation to continue to recover their capital costs at the new hospital rate. The board's construction here, keyed to the historical tracing of these assets, also has other problems. The board, if you look at their rationalization, said we're concerned about essentially a double payment or double reimbursement situation. And that is a principle that they derive from nowhere in the rulemaking history as far as the regulatory definition of the new hospital goes. It's not in 13...
No, the
same person where you have an existing entrant, but we are not an existing entrant.
So, right,
we are a brand new entrant.
This is what agencies do all the time is, you know, we gave you some things we were thinking of. My only point is you said, where does this double payment thing come from? You know, well, 1 and 2 seem to say, look, you know, we want to save this for folks that really are having to lay stuff out for the very first time because those don't have other things around them that give them protections from these new entrants.
And that is precisely the position that each of the plaintiff hospitals is in this case. And the fact that
they... What they did here then is, as agencies do, is they said, now we'll look at you. You're a different factual scenario from precisely what we have in the regulation. But we've determined that, you know what, we think it's similar enough for our concerns when you're putting yourself where a hospital's been before. Or within an existing hospital or where a hospital's been before, that you're going to trigger some, maybe not every case, maybe you can show in your case you don't fall within it, but as a general categorical matter, people within that box are not going to qualify as new hospitals.
Well, Your Honor, I think in that circumstance, that simply cannot be squared with what the Secretary said at the time these regulations were adopted. And that is what should be controlling under Thomas Jefferson University and other cases that we've cited in our briefs. The other problem here, and it's analytically flawed too, because it misses the point that the leases here and the rent that's paid on those leases are not the same as costs that are incurred in constructing bricks and mortar facilities. There's a different, the lease is the asset that the hospitals acquired here. And that is a completely new asset that has no origin or connection to a prior to use by a prior hospital at all under the scenario. And so the board analytically missed that point, which is a simple matter of economics and property rights and finance. So there's that. There is in fact no literal double payment here for the same asset. The other thing that's missing here, and this I think goes back to the point about the purpose of it, is there, if you look at the rulemaking statements, there is nothing in the rulemaking statements that reflects an intent to discriminate between two institutions that are both new entrants, but one that builds on a green field from the ground up, and another that leases or acquires all or some of its assets from other providers through arm's length transactions at commercially reasonable rates.
How much of your capital costs would be, what is the ratio of capital costs that are the lease versus other capital expenditures that were made to get these things up and running, whether it's equipment, sanitization, materials, plumbing, I don't know what all, electronics?
Let me give you a two-part answer. The first part answer is, unfortunately, I don't know with respect to the overall actual decision to construct and to come in and enter into a market here. With respect to the way costs have been allocated and claimed here for purposes of Medicare reimbursements, a large portion of it is rent. That is in those periods. But again, the rent are costs that we have actually incurred for the asset that we acquired, which was, as a matter of property law, a new asset. The other point about this double recovery, double reimbursement point that is, I think, particularly fallacious in the board's reasoning is their construction of the new hospital definition here does not actually prevent any kind of double reimbursement or payment to the extent that one might be said to be there. There is absolutely no dispute in this case that we will be reimbursed for our capital costs. And in fact, in general, broadly speaking, we already have received about $50,000 through the capital prospective payment system for each of the hospitals at issue here. The problem is that in the years in question, we should have received approximately $250,000. I'm averaging. The numbers are back and forth, but for the specific hospitals. So we definitely will be reimbursed. The question is just about the rate, and the rate should be set by the fact that we are new entrants into the facility. And by the record here, if it were relevant, and I'm not entirely sure it is, but by the record here, have incurred the kinds of costs that are typical of anyone. And a rule, by the way, that keys new hospital status to the provenance of the institution's assets and how they're acquired would have extraordinarily perverse economic effects. First of all, it would raise barriers to entry, and it would make it more difficult for hospitals to start up and enter into markets. It would skew decisions to whether or not to build new facilities on green fields or lease and renovate existing facilities. And it would essentially do something that the Secretary had no indication was on the Secretary's mind in 1991 and 1992, which is essentially exclude co-located hospitals that have facilities in the same building or campus as an existing hospital completely from the ability to obtain new hospital status. That was something that the text doesn't do and something that no regulation ever did.
Let's hear from appellees.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Joshua Waldman, here from the Department of Justice, representing the appellee, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Congress gave the Secretary broad discretion to make what the statute calls appropriate exceptions to Medicare's reimbursement for capital-related costs. And the Secretary's regulation provides greater reimbursement for, quote, new hospitals. The Secretary interprets her regulation to require the new hospital to have two components, both a new business entity that provides medical services and a new physical bricks-and-mortar asset. And the Secretary further interprets her rule to mean that the physical assets must be built from the ground up rather than mere renovations of an existing building.
That would be true even if instead of building on land that was formerly a hospital, they built on land that was formerly a Home Depot?
Well, I think it would be open under this rule, and as the board and administrator announced in its decision, it could theoretically be open to go either way on that question. For example, something that was wholly built by someone else but then bought by the new entity, is that your hypothetical?
Out what your rule is. It is very hard for me to figure out what the Secretary's rule is from this decision. Is it that we only want to reimburse people who build, you know, entities who build from the ground up, or only folks who build from the ground up on non-prior hospital land that was not previously a hospital?
Right. I don't think, in this case, the Secretary didn't face that question, and there were two components to the decision. One was merely renovating something that has previously existed as a building. We're not going to treat that the same as a new build.
And that would be whether the building was previously a hospital or not.
That's true.
Any renovations are completely out.
Yes. For example, if you bought a library and turned it into a hospital, you would face sort of whether that component of the decision is itself sufficient. The second part was this double reimbursement, which does depend.
We don't care about double reimbursement. Okay. As long as you haven't, right, I just want to make sure, are these independent tests? And that is, if you haven't built from the ground up, mm-hmm. I don't care where you did it or who you are that did it, you don't get this money. We only want primary construction under the statute.
Well, I don't think that we know yet whether the Secretary would say that part of the test is alone sufficient. And here it relied on two grounds, which it found to be in combination to mean that these hospitals were not new hospitals. In another case where someone, say, leased space in a Home Depot to run an acute care hospital, it's hard to imagine that being the case. But if they did, I think that the Secretary would be faced with the question of whether that ground alone, you haven't built something new, and that's alone reason not to call you a new hospital. I think the Secretary would have to face that, and it's open to her to, I think, go either way.
So what is the test for new hospital for this board? We're going to ask, did you build from the ground up? And if the answer is yes, then we say, and did you build where there was previously a hospital? And they would have to say no, and then there could be a new hospital. But if they said yes and yes, they're out. I'm trying to figure out how the two prongs fit together.
Well, I think they don't
seem at all related to me. This double reimbursement and building from the ground up seem very...
Well, they're certainly not dependent on each other. They could be viewed as independent from one another.
It's not clear whether you have to meet both, one or both.
In this case, they fail both parts of it.
Are they interpreting new hospital to be both? You don't get to think of, I mean, you get a lot of discretion, but you don't get to make up a new rule for each person that shows up in front of the Secretary. So is the definition now that you have to be both or one or the other?
I think the definition now is you have to be both a new entity and you have to have the new facility. And the only thing that the Secretary clarified here is that a renovation is not the same as a new building, and therefore you are not a new hospital. But I think the Secretary is leaving open what happens in the next case where what you renovated has never been a hospital. She was not facing that here, so I don't think that she's answered the question yet of what if you have one condition but not the other.
If you have two new entities right next to each other, mm-hmm. and one of them goes where it was previously a hospital or some sort of clinic, and one goes right next door where the Starbucks used to be. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, they're completely new.
Mm-hmm.
Completely, you don't have any arguments about ownership or the regulations or anything. And one gets it and one doesn't just because it was a Starbucks rather than a...
Well, no, I don't think we know yet whether the one in the Starbucks would get it. The secretary would have to say in the Starbucks...
The secretary said new hospital might turn on whether it's a Starbucks or not, previously a Starbucks or not.
Well, what the secretary said here is that there's a particular concern when the thing that you're renovating was previously built and operated as a hospital. And the reason there's a particular concern is that we have already paid at a higher rate for the capital cost of building that hospital. And if we pay it a second time at the higher rate, that's two times.
Okay, and what evidence in the record was that you had paid at this location before?
Because they had operated at hospitals that were Medicare eligible. And I think the secretary...
In the board decision, I just didn't see the evidence in the board decision. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think the other side says the prior owners didn't get Medicare reimbursement.
Right. I don't know that there's any evidence in the record
that I'm aware of.
But I think what the secretary is entitled to do is to say, I'm making sort of general presumptions.
The board said presumably.
Yes. And I think that the board and the secretary are entitled to make rules that are based on general presumptions about things that will happen, even if it's not true in all.
The second time I said was limited to assets for which the Medicare program has not previously made.
Yeah.
So that was the presumably didn't show up in the next round.
Okay. I mean, I can't speak to why the word presumably didn't come up in the second round. I don't know. But I can.
We know as a matter, it's not the board decision. We know whether payments went to these prior. I mean, one of them hadn't been there for 10 years.
I don't know whether they had been reimbursed under a higher rate or not. These old hospitals.
What evidence is there for this new rule? I mean, what evidence is there even for this presumption?
Well, I think what the reason is that if you are building or renovating in a space that has previously existed as a hospital, there is a concern that this double counting would happen. And so I think the board is just trying to avoid the risk and that possibility, even if it's not necessarily true in every case.
But
and
then
it's,
when you deal with that double, when only double counting would be as to the land, right? Either buying the land or leasing the land. But
or construction of the entire building as well.
So, well, if we're assuming they've completely gutted it and renovated it, then that wouldn't apply. But there's an awful lot of capital costs in the definition of capital costs that go beyond just the lease or the mortgage.
Right.
And so as to those, there's zero risk, zero of double payments. So isn't the secretary sort of doing overkill here to say if there was a hospital there 50 years ago, you're done for?
It might be, and that might be why in another case the secretary could say, although I viewed this as an alternative reason or an additional persuasive reason, it's not ultimately dispositive. And what's dispositive is whether you build something new or whether you're just merely renovating. And the secretary may take that position in a future case. She didn't face it here.
What's the rationale for building versus renovating? I don't know what either one of those has to do with the word new.
Well, the reason is if the secretary is entitled, as we think she is, to look at the physical assets of the hospital in determining whether it's new, she is then faced with the question of, you know, what makes an asset new or not? And she said, well, in this particular case, first of all, when I promulgated the regulation, I said I was going to focus on assets, and I specifically mentioned newly built facilities. And B1 itself refers to new or replacement facilities. And then she said, also, everyone's going to get reimbursement for the capital cost, but one person gets a greater reimbursement than another. And I'm going to reserve that extra benefit for those with the greatest and most compelling needs. And the secretary reasonably concluded here that newly built facilities are a more compelling need because there's greater capital costs.
I have a lot of trouble with that reading of newly built because the language before it and the language after it talked about what I had thought were the originating rationales for this exception, and that is barriers to essentially economic barriers that new entrants face. And when you read it in that you don't have capital reserves, that you have to have a huge outlay, and you don't yet have the relationship with the community, with your business ground legs, or the patient flow, These are the types of barriers. That's what we're concerned about. That's what they said before and after newly built. And if that's the context in which we look at that sentence, then it's got nothing to do with construction versus completely gutting something and renovating it. It's got everything to do with how completely independent are you from prior hospitals, and are you facing those economic barriers? And you can face that just as much gutting and renovating a place as you can doing construction on something where something existed before.
Well, I think that when you look at the portion of the Federal Register that you're referring to, they do talk about difficulties for new entrants. But the reason they talk about it is that they have problems having capital reserves for capital-related costs, the building of the assets. And the reason why it's more of a concern for a new build than for renovation is building an entire facility from the ground up costs a lot more, as a general matter, than renovations.
I don't know if that's true, I agree on that, but you all have a definition. I mean, the problem here I have is you start with physical assets, and then you turn it into the bricks and mortar. Mm-hmm. And that's not the same thing, because you have a regulation that defines capital-related costs, to include leases, by the way.
Right.
And thing, you know, equipment and things like that. And you take the rationale, you take the definition of capital-related costs, and how the Secretary has now said, in this case, that we're going to reduce this down to, did you build the building, and did you build it where a Starbucks was or a Minute Clinic was, and that's going to make all the difference. It seems very disconnected from the originating rationales to me.
Well, I don't think that it is, but I think it takes an understanding of how you get there from the beginning to the very end. In the beginning, the Secretary said, look, the determining factor, these are her words, the determining factor should be directly related to the hospital's assets rather than its operations. And so the first question is, does the statute permit and does the regulation, in fact, focus on the assets itself? And the Secretary...
Well, assets definitely means more than just lease versus mortgage.
Right. No, I understand that their first threshold argument is the statute doesn't even permit you to look at assets when you're figuring out how much you're paying for the assets. We don't think that that's right. And if you agree with us that the Secretary is entitled to look at the assets in determining whether the hospital is new, the next question is it reasonable to separate the more expensive projects from the less expensive projects when you're figuring out who gets the higher reimbursement rate from limited funds of Medicare? And the Secretary's view was, look, renovations just aren't going to be as expensive and therefore as difficult to these new entrants the way a newly built facility would be. And so
we're... They could have all the same barriers that the construction would, that the renovators could have the same barriers. They wouldn't have the patient flow. They wouldn't have the relationship with the community. They might, and they wouldn't have capital reserves.
Right, but they would...
Now
But their capital costs would be lower, and therefore it's less of a problem for them.
So that you got four prongs, and you said three of those we don't care about anymore. We just care about capital costs. We don't care about reserves, patient flow, or relationship.
We do care about those, because if you're not a new entrant and therefore don't have those problems, then you fail at the first part of the test. So we do care about that. We just say that's not the end of the question. It's the beginning of the question.
Of course, there's a factual assumption that renovation is less costly than new construction. It might not always be true.
Well, it may not always be true. It was, in fact, in this case, true. And as we cite in a footnote in our brief, there was testimony about this at the hearing.
Did you make that finding?
No.
I don't have the brief in front of me right now, but there's a footnote in our brief in which there's...
Where did the board make the finding that the reason we're doing this is because construction is more of an outlay than renovation?
Oh, there was language to the effect of, to compare mere limited renovations to a newly built facility, I think they use the word, is simply disingenuous. I might not.
I don't remember that part. Did they say that?
Yes, the board did say that.
Do you have a J page on that?
Let me.
Or if not, I mean, let me know later.
This is in the first agency proceeding. It was. On page 19 of my brief, which cites to Joint Appendix page 160, that's the Bloomington decision, and 236, which is the Augusta decision, the board thought it was simply disingenuous to compare the capital costs that are limited to renovations to those for a newly built facility.
That's under the heading intermediaries contentions. It's not until 161 that you get findings of facts, conclusions of law, and discussion.
Right.
I'm just saying what the intermediary contended there.
Right, but I think that the board... So
the board didn't make any finding of facts like that.
Well, it certainly heard testimony that it was less costly to lease the facilities than to build new, which was the testimony from the other side. It was informed of this. It was informed of the intermediary's decision. I think it's fairly included. You can find it fairly included in the board's decision that they noted this fact, that there was testimony on it before the board, and that even if it's not true in every case, you can certainly, I'm not going to resist the idea that there's some renovation that may be more costly than a new build. But the secretary in administering this vast Medicare regime is entitled to make general presumptions about things that it knows to be usually true, rather than have fiscal intermediaries in every case have mini hearings in which one side presents a hypothetical build that didn't happen and what they think its cost would be versus their renovations.
I also seem to assume that the lessors here were hospitals on 162, which wasn't true either.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your
on
question.
On page 162, it says each lessor hospital operated as a hospital, but there aren't the hospitals here. The lessors are not hospitals. Is that correct?
The,
that was another mistake?
I think they probably meant leasee rather than leasor. It's,
no, because it says operate as a hospital for more than 2 years prior to the execution of the decision. No, it definitely seemed to be thinking that the lessors here were hospitals as part of its sort of double payment concern, but that wasn't true.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow what your question was.
So on J162,
uh-huh.
You have that. You see the we find paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the board finds that applying the exemption where each lessor hospital operated as a hospital for more than 2 years prior to the execution of the lease agreements in the same space as the provider, I think the provider are the new folks.
Yeah.
Okay, so the lessor. So they seem to predicate in this case, that they are not new hospitals. But that's just wrong factually. They weren't lessor hospitals.
They were.
I'm pretty sure the brief says that the two in the freestanding cases are not.
I think they leased the building, I think, from the owner of the building, the freestanding. What's that?
But it's not a hospital. I mean, if they can tell me if I'm wrong.
I think it was prior. It used to be a hospital, but then it wasn't a hospital for some period of time immediately before. And then what happened in this case is the district court said, because of that sentence, I'm not sure whether you intend to go so far as to reach these freestanding hospitals, and she remanded for that purpose. And then on remand, the administrator said, no.
This is not the remand decision. This is the final decision. The page 20 of the brief says that neither landlord is a hospital.
Your Honor, this isn't the remand decision.
Right, I know. So that's what this is
right.
This case that we're reviewing that says that their lessors are hospitals, and for that reason, we think they're not new, but it's not true.
When this decision went up to the district court read that sentence that you're talking about and says, I don't know whether you're actually trying to apply your rule to these freestanding hospitals in light of that sentence. And so she remanded back to the secretary, the district court did, in order to clarify, do you mean to reach the freestanding hospitals? And then in the supplemental opinion issued by the administrator, this is on in begins at 349, the administrator issued another decision saying, yes, I did mean to reach the freestanding hospitals. It doesn't matter if there's a gap from when they used to be a hospital, then there was a gap, now you're leasing it. That doesn't matter. And then it went back to the district court, and the district court issued its second decision saying, okay, I affirm that as well. Mm-hmm. So I understand why you see some ambiguity there, but that's exactly why the district court remanded it back to the administrator to clarify, do you mean to reach the freestanding hospitals? Mm-hmm. And the administrator said yes, it does reach that.
All right. Anything further?
Not unless your honors have any further questions.
Can I just ask a fact question? How often do you get 3-2 board splits like this?
I'm sorry, I don't have any answer for that. I don't know the answer to that question.
And you can see they're not within the B1 exceptions, right?
That's right. I think, as Your Honor pointed out, they come very close, but the board itself found they did not fall within any of the four exceptions, exemplary exemptions that are in B1, 2, 3, and 4. If there are no further questions?
Mayor, I'm sorry, just one more.
Sure.
One of the things that was confusing was the board focused so much on whether they're hospitals rather than new. Mm-hmm. When they say hospital, I think you would concede that they're certainly a hospital for purposes of the statutory provision that gives them the lower reimbursement rate. They're just not a hospital for purposes of the higher reimbursement rate.
That's right. There's no question that they get the regular PPS reimbursement.
So different definition of hospital depending on which rate you get.
Well, what happens is the statute itself just specifies a PPS for everyone. And everyone gets that if you're Medicare eligible, unless you come within an exception. And Congress said to the Secretary, make exceptions that you think are appropriate. And she did it for new hospitals. So that's how it comes about. But there's no dispute that if you are Medicare eligible hospital and you don't fall into an exception, you get the capital PPS rate. Or in this case, now they get the long-term care hospital PPS rate because that's what they are certified as now. And if there are any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for appellants.
I think, first, as a general observation from the prior discussion you had with my opponent, I think it's clear that what's going on here is that the decision that's been produced here does not actually contain any coherent construction of the Medicare regulation at issue at all. And in fact, what it is it simply produces a result with no coherent construction of the regulation at all. There has to be a coherent construction that's at least linked to the text and should be linked to the statements of purpose of the Secretary. What the board did here is essentially engage in de facto rulemaking under the guise of an interpretation. That's not permissible. The arguments that we've heard from my opponent today, which are very eloquent and thoughtful, are essentially post hoc rationalizations that also can't be credited by this court. So for all of those reasons, none of that should support the board's decision. And that's a very simple response to everything that you just heard from my opponent.
Have you seen these 3-2 splits like this often or not?
Your Honor, I can't give a precise circumstance. I don't practice before the board on a regular basis. But my understanding is that they are very rare. Your Honor, I think Judge Millett quite well pointed out that leases are capital costs here that are permitted under that. It's strange to think that the build versus lease and renovate distinction that has been advanced here today would make any sense in light of that. You asked my opponent about evidence to support this presumption that the costs had been paid previously. There is absolutely none of that in the record. If you look at the rulemaking, as I said previously, there is absolutely no evidence of any intent to discriminate amongst different entrants based on whether they build or renovate or lease and renovate existing facilities. And the fact that leases are recoverable suggests that there should be no such distinction. We've completely left behind any consideration that the term hospital is ambiguous. I think everyone here now agrees that hospital, both in the Medicare statute and as it's used in the regulation, refers to an institution that operates facilities. There was a question about a statement in the board's decision. There was a comment by my opponent about a statement in the board's decision that the determining factor should be not the hospital's operations, but its assets. I hope I have that right. The regulation itself says operations. The rulemaking statements of the Secretary says operations. Judge Millett has already pointed out the problem with the limited renovations point that's in counsel's brief. That does actually appear in the intermediary's contention. It's not a finding. There was a lot of discussion about whether or not it is less costly to lease than to build. The short answer is we do not know in this case or in general, but it would be bizarre for the Secretary to have intended in 1992 and 2002, when these regulations were adopted, to create a cost recovery rule that encouraged and only provided new hospitals when new entrants engaged in the more costly work, if you assume that building from the ground up is more costly. At the end of the day, the system will wind up paying more as a result of people that enter and have to go in and build up from scratch on ground fields in order to come within this exception. There was a discussion, too, about this, the reference in the board's decision about lesser hospitals, and that led to some discussion about what was actually at issue on the remand to the board. Let me be clear about that. The issue on remand to the board was not about the lessor identity of the hospitals, but it was about the fact that there was a greater than 2-year gap the time in which the assets, the buildings, the bricks and mortar, had been used by a prior medical facility, a 10-year gap in the case of Victoria, a 2-year gap in the case of Dallas. So that was the issue that was before the board when it was remanded, not some question about the lessors. But to answer the question about the lessors, what we cited in our brief is in the administrative record, I believe it's for the Bloomington case at 708 and 715. I don't have the full administrative record here, so at the moment I don't actually recall what those specific citations were, but that's where you can look for it to find out exactly what was said about that. The freestanding hospitals, Victoria and South Dallas, my understanding is, based on what we said in our brief, and I believe it's correct because I wrote it, it is that they do not have landlords who are hospitals. Of course, the hospitals that are co-located with other hospitals do have landlords that are hospitals. Our position here is that for purposes of defining what a new hospital is, absolutely none of that is relevant under the text of the regulation or the history of it. Any reasonable construction of this regulation should include hospitals like us that had no assets prior to entering the market and went through a startup period.
Two freestanding hospitals, I know they went to a location where a hospital had been before. Did they go to a building or did they build from the ground up?
My understanding is that they took possession of existing buildings and extensively renovated them. I cannot say how extensive the renovations are off the top of my head. I do know in the case of Victoria, that building had been vacant for 10 years. And I can say something about the renovations that we did in all of the facilities generally. They were extraordinarily extensive. They involved demolitions. They involved removal of all existing facilities. They involved asbestos abatements in some cases. Construction of new electrical, gas, and data systems, installation of fixed and movable equipment, constructions of spaces for beds, clinical works, labs, pharmacies, record keeping. The notion that we were coming in and simply changing the paint on an existing facility is completely belied by the record. And in that sense, the record shows that we had experiences and incurred costs that were typical of any new entrant. We should have been treated like any new entrant should be treated under this regulation, and we should have received reimbursement at the new hospital rate. If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to have them. If not, thank you for your time.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.